Hello and welcome to episode 88 of the Crate and Crowbar, a PC gaming podcast. We're recording this on the 15th of April 2015. My name is Chris Thurston and today I'm joined by Tom Senior.
Hello.
Marsh Davies.
Hello.
Tom Francis.
Hello.
And the intonation suggests I'm going to say another name. And myself, Chris Thurston. Can't count. But who can count? Marsh. Marsh?
Yes.
How many? Don't make me count, I'm a humanities project.
Okay.
Don't end badly.
How many games have you played this week that you want to talk about in the podcast?
Happily, it's less than five, so I can actually count that high. I want to talk about Deadbolt, which is a game that Tom Francis recommended to me. And you can play it for free, because it's on itch.io. Or itch.io.
I think it's...
itch.io. You can play it on
just
that website.
Itch.io, or one thing.
We'll go with that. It's a what even is it, itch.io? It's like some kind of massive indie... you can buy things on there, but it also seems that people put up games for free there.
Yeah, I think it maybe started as a way to distribute your game for free, but allow people to donate if they wanted to.
Right.
And so originally it was most things on there would pay what you want, and these days you can set a minimum price, which means people have to pay that much, but they can also pay more if they want. And also they've kind of, I think you can also just set a single price, and so like Gone Home is on there now, and some bigger games are coming to it now.
Well, this doesn't seem to have a donate button.
It doesn't seem to have been intentionally released.
Oh.
The page says, oh, I guess this is out there now.
Huh.
Or it sounds like he put it up there for someone specific, and then the link got around, and now he's like, oh, I guess people are playing this, so play if you like, but it's an early alpha.
Well, in this game, you play as Death, who is being commanded by his fireplace to kill zombie drug dealers. And this falls
Fireplaces
out.
Hate zombie drug dealers.
Their natural enemy. Well, actually, there is a kind of mythos behind it.
You know way more about the lore of this game than I do.
Well, not intentionally. You have to read it in order to get the missions given to you. It seems that by remaining in unlife, they have not committed their souls to the fire of, which is in some way some kind of celestial goal for all living beings to return to the fire.
Get into the fireplace.
Get into the fireplace. So, yeah, so
get
the
in
fireplace,
there. Come on,
Granddad.
The fireplace needs you to do some reaping for it. And it proceeds in a manner not entirely dissimilar from Hotline Miami meets Gunpoint. Let's go with that.
That's the tagline.
That crude comparison.
I think it should be called Gunshoot.
it's more gunpointy than Gunpoint was in the actual...
Certainly point a gun a lot more.
Yeah.
You also fire it almost every time.
Yes. Yeah. So it's a side-on game. It looks visually not totally incomparable to Gunpoint in that you're looking at cutaway buildings, multiple floors, and it has, you know, the similar sorts of interaction with the environment in terms of being able to go through doors and appear on the floor above. Like the language of those levels is very similar to Gunpoint, but the manner in which you go through them is very similar to Hotline Miami. Like, you know, you have to tap dudes in the head with minimum number of shots because you have very limited ammo resources. You can't move and shoot at the same time, but you do have full kind of mouse movement, so you can aim in an arc, although pretty much everything is at head height, so
yeah.
You not much point firing to the ceiling.
It's exactly the same thing of going up to a closed door and looking at who's in there and figuring out, okay, if I shoot that guy first, that guy's going to hear me and this is going to happen, and therefore I should, you know, strategize in this way and take out those three and then quickly duck behind that thing and then I can take out those other guys, which is exactly like Hotline Miami, only it's a different two dimensions.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. There's also some sort of extra navigational element in that you can... go through vents, although you kind of just puff into smoke, and there's a noise of a Zippo lighter being flicked open. I don't know why that sound effect, but it's a really nice sound effect, which means you can transfer yourself between vents in different parts of the building, and also toilets. And if you do that and somebody's sitting on the toilet, they explode.
Have you actually done that in game, right?
Yeah,
now I know why Marsh has been playing this game. Toilet assassination.
Why does the ventilation link to the loos?
I don't think it does. I think the loos always link to like a drain outside and vents link to each other.
Yes, that's
but you go through both
plausible,
the same way.
Actually. Yes. But it's extremely...
That's not my only problem with this high concept.
Just terrible building planning. Wire the toilet directly to the vents.
Yeah.
Poo is just constantly pouring out into the rooms.
Yeah. But it's really snappy and great and extremely hard. Mm. I don't know that I can ever get past level 4.
I think... I think I'm better than level 4, therefore it's possible.
Is the level 4 you have to assassinate little
Yeah,
snuff?
I've just done that one. Oh, no, wait, no, I haven't actually done it. I assassinated him.
Oh, you did?
And then a bunch of people showed up, and they were easy people to kill, and I just fucked it up in the stupidest way ever. And it's on video, and you can watch it right now.
Oh, really? Awesome. Oh, I'll link that in the show notes.
I did a video of this, and I played it before. I played the first 3 levels or something. I hadn't played that one, but I played it all the ones leading up to it. And so for the video, I replayed the latest one I'd done, so that it was known territory. So I could explain the mechanics, and then went on to the one that I didn't know, and did like 6 attempts at that level, and fucked up pretty badly. But the way I actually died was like a crowbar guy. I was just running away from him, and then I tried to hide in a bathroom, close the door behind me. I had a gun with like 10 shots. I could have easily killed him, but I was trying to... There was other people behind him, and I was worried about what was going to happen next. And it's all about figuring out not just can I kill this guy, but when I kill this guy, who else is coming running, and do I have enough ammo to deal with it? Ammo is really scarce. It's like you get a gun, and it's just that mag and nothing else. I mean, I say this in Gunpoint, you get 6 bullets for the entire game.
Yeah, but you don't ever need to shoot it. Really,
yeah,
so.
Yeah. So it's all about like the challenge is how do you get through this with this little ammo. Mm.
Yeah, and the enemies don't always drop weapons either, which means that
hardly ever.
Yeah, you need to find weapons on levels and make your way to them while conserving ammo. But what I really like about it, other than the fact that it's just fairly simple, really, but enjoyable to play. But there are lots of, and there aren't as many kind of affordances in the levels as something like Gunpoint. But like we said, maybe he didn't mean to release it this early. I don't know, but they're just. Loads of really nice animation touches. Like, it looked just the animation of it, which is simple pixel art. It looks super, super sweet. There's little touches like you go back to your fireplace and you walk past the table and it just says, fix photo. And he just sets up a photo frame correctly on the table, which had fallen down. And it just looks really nice. And when he opens, like, fridges to get behind them as cover, like the doors kind of spang a little bit when they open. But it's all done, it's all suggested with like the minimum number of pixels to communicate the fact that the door's kind of reverbing. And I really admire.
You love a good spang.
I do love a good spang. Yeah, in the fridge.
I find the gunplay in it really, really satisfying, and it's one of the most satisfying shooters.
The sound of those bullets is astonishing. Like, I had to turn the volume way, way down on my PC because it's louder than... Or if maybe it's not actually kind of, in terms of the raw decibels, louder, but there's a harshness to the way those shots resound, which just sounds super horrible. And, people's brain pans just explode and kind of cast what seem to be beautiful procedural blood splatters across the wall, which is another point of admiration.
Which is great because in a 2D game, there's always a back wall. There's always, like, no matter where you're shooting, there's always a wall for blood to splatter onto. So every single kill makes this massive streak of blood. Mm. And if you, like, shoot them with a sawn-off shotgun, they often get shredded into little chunks and those bounce around. I had one, like, bounce through a door.
Spanging and well-rendered bodily fluids as, like, 2 tick boxes for a fighting game.
You can throw knives.
Yes, yeah. You can
pick up kitchen knives and stab people with them and throw them. And I think that's, like, completely silent, which is awesome. And just all the guns are really good, and shooting people in the head is really satisfying because that's like they take a lot of shots, it seems, if you go for the body. So you have to get headshots, and so when you do that, it just feels really like proficient. It just feels like being a proper assassin, like walking into a room just shooting every single person in the head exactly, and then it just being over. And the game kind of pushes you towards that style because of the incredible rarity of ammo.
How do you take down the big dudes with the short-off shotguns? Because I did it with a revolver on the previous levels, but then I'm at a level, the aforementioned impossible level, where I run out of bullets before I even encounter one of those guys, and so I need to pick up the machine gun, but it seems like I can just empty an entire clip into one of them and it doesn't do anything.
I did kill them with a Tommy gun, but I was hiding behind a TV when I did it, so I was able to like pop out, spray a load of bullets, and then when they fired, I just randomly ducked down, and it happened to be when they fired, and then... Yeah. It takes them so long to reload. There was 2 of them, and after one of them had fired, it seemed like neither of them could fire again for like 2 seconds. So I mowed them down that way. I felt like every now and then I've killed them really fast, so I think it is possible to hit them in the head, even though they're kind of taller than you. Depending on the angle. I think if you're close to them, it might not be possible, or just not easy or not intuitive. If you can shoot them in the head, I think that makes them go down faster.
It's super cool. It has that just instant replay thing where it doesn't really matter that you've died. In fact, your deaths are often kind of pathetic in some way.
Yeah, I had one where, because you run out of ammo, that's often how you die, and I had one where, like, right at the start of the level, again, you can watch this, because it's actually in my video, but I tried to deal with the first room, and a heavy guy came from the upper floor down to chase me, and I just wasted a bunch of bullets on somebody, and I literally had no ammo at all, and outside, I was in the dark, but there's a street lamp in front of your car. You pull up to these missions in a really fancy, kind of old-fashioned car, and there's a street lamp between my car and the door, and I'm between the street lamp and the door. And so I'm in the dark, and the zombie can't see me, but he's just kind of wandering around randomly, and eventually he's going to wander close enough to me. And I can't shoot him because I've got no ammo, and I can't go backwards because I'll be in the light, and I can't go forwards because they can see you within a certain range in the dark. So I'm just like, I'm just going to stand here and wait for death.
And you are death, the irony.
And then when he actually walked up to me, the heavy guys, the ones with the sawn-off shotguns, and so he just blew me into just chunks, and you just saw, like, my skull just roll into the streetlight. It was really good.
Yeah, I kind of wish there was more of an ability to come back from those situations. Like Hotline Miami, you can always kill people with your hands, however, regardless of how unlikely that is. And it would be...
You're deaf here, so you'd think you'd have some way of...
No, in Hotline Miami too.
No?
One of its biggest flaws is that there are completely fist-proof enemies that require a gun. It's the same problem. It's the, I've now fucked myself because I can't get to the tool that is necessary for this enemy.
Can you throw your guns?
Yes.
Yeah, that's the one.
That doesn't work on gun... They're bullets. Oh. They need bullets. You can't just, like... It's not like they're allergic to gun, particularly. Like, yes, gun. Like, the nature of their invulnerability is if they touch a gun, they die. No, it's the bullets, really.
Yeah.
Can you throw bullets?
No.
Well, it's good anyway, so you should play it.
Sounds good.
Yeah, it's fun. I like it. From one hyper-violent fantasy to another, what have you been playing, Chris Thurston?
I have been playing Grand Theft Auto V, which is a popular computer game with primary school children, apparently. Which came out on PC at long last after a 18-month delay this week. I'm reviewing it for PCG. Primarily, I think, because I'm basically the only person who... has never played it before in any form prior to this one.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I had no experience of the console version at all. So I kind of come at it from the point of view of somebody who's treating it like an action game release this year, I guess. And again, I'm not going to lie, having read a lot of things about it over the 18 months that people had time to play it and write things about it, I wasn't expecting to be blown away by it because of a bunch of things. Mostly to do with the single player campaign. I really, really like Grand Theft Auto 4 for context, and I really, really invested a lot in that game when it came out. I also really like Red Dead Redemption, but I've always had sort of concerns about where Rockstar's kind of like creative direction was going with the kinds of games they were making, the kinds of stories they were interested in telling. Particularly the way that certain parts of their storytelling matures really rapidly, particularly from a technical point of view, the fidelity of the world and the quality of the motion capture and the acting and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Whereas other parts of it don't mature at all. There's great swathes of GTA that are still a kind of punky, DMA designs game from the 90s, where just being able to run people over is subversive and cool. And, we were talking the other day, Marsh, about how GTA 4 was almost the game that invented ludonarrative dissonance drink.
Great.
Or at least it was one of the first times where the narrative ambitions of a game and the fidelity of the world the game was set in clashed so dramatically with what you actually do in the game that it would be notable. They had this quite well-realised protagonist in Niko Bellic.
But I think that's to its credit that it had those ambitions in the first place, even if it was problematic.
Sure. And GTA 5 is fascinating to me because not only does it not care to solve any of those issues that are raised in GTA 4, where it's like, hey, you're this person who's ostensibly real, and we put all this effort into making them look and sound real, but they do ludicrous things every day, and they operate in a world that is realistic to look at, but deeply gamey in its kind of execution. Not only ignore it, they actually kind of start hanging lampshades on it really, really quickly in the single player campaign of GTA 5, which is where I started. So, because I decided I was going to start with the critical path and kind of work through it, to an extent, and. It has three protagonists. You switch between those protagonists in a technique that's actually kind of cool in its sort of technical execution, being able to flip between people and kind of find out what they were doing in the world before you went back to them. But it's also kind of far more aggressively gamey from the beginning than GTA 4 is. Like, people forget that you don't kill someone for quite a while in GTA 4. Like, your first missions are all, like, low-level crime, driving around, stuff like that. It really invests in telling the world. And the first time you have to grab a gun and shoot somebody is actually quite a big deal. This game opens with a massive gunfight. There's a massive gunfight in the tutorial, but also, like, one of the first missions for Franklin, who is the most confused character they've written in that game. Franklin is a kind of a young black guy from Los Santos, L.A., who starts the game having previously run with gangs, no longer wanting to run with gangs, working legitimately, actually, but in something that's kind of shady, but it's at least a real job. And then you have to go, and he's a repo man, he goes and picks up, you know, vehicles from people who can't pay off the bills anymore, which is how they teach you, you know, picking up vehicles and driving around. But you're sent to pick up a bike, and in picking up a bike, which is ostensibly a legitimate activity and it hasn't been paid for, you kill an entire Latin American street gang. And afterwards, your friend says, Franklin says, you know, man, I don't know what's up with this, like, 1980s action movie body count you've got going. And it tries to hang a line through, and it's like, well, that's not his fault. Like, he didn't choose this entire scenario to be totally absurd and kind of lose you from the beginning. Because he's also this, like, he's this nice young man who tries to help out in his community and helps people in the same neighborhood as him for free. And then guns down an entire gang full of people in, like, the first couple of missions with him. Yeah. Later on, there's a moment where, this is no spoilers or not for the very, very beginning of the game. You know, you switch over to controlling Michael, who's a former bank robber, retired, bored, having a bit of a midlife crisis, whatever. And, you know, he has kids that don't appreciate him and a wife that doesn't appreciate him. And it hints that his wife is sleeping with his cartoon tennis coach. His cartoon wife is sleeping with his cartoon tennis coach, because that's the kind of thing cartoons would do. And she does. And then when he's driving to get his revenge with Franklin, he says, man, I can't believe she did that. And it's such a cliche as well. And it's like, yes, it is a gigantic, gigantic cliche. Like, I don't know why that's clever. Like, just deploying a cliche without any kind of sense. So there's this weird thing where there's the effort expended in creating these characters in this world they occupy is extraordinary. Like, it is the best. It's the most difficult to make looking game I think I've ever seen. It looks like it was really, really hard to do all the things that game does.
It does, yeah.
Like, there's shitloads of bespoke textures and animation for everything, and little mini games that crop up once and are never seen again, because everything has kind of been obsessively handcrafted by presumably the army of studios that Rockstar fired at this thing for years and years and years to get it right. And there are these little kind of, and yet it can't escape telling the same story Rockstar always tell.
Well, it's not the same story. No, actually, it's not. What's so frustrating is that in all their previous characters, at least the ones that I've liked, the characters are presented with no other choice but to do their actions. Mm. Like, and that's also frustrating, because you end up doing missions for douchebags and you can kill millions of people, and yet you're still, you know, obeying the orders of some gravedigger who you hate, or whatever. And yet all those characters start out as in some way impoverished or without power and beholden to the power of others. And in this, all of the characters you play have all the choices in the world. They don't need to do any of the terrible shit they do. They just do it anyway.
Yeah.
And you're just like saying, well, why? Why am I doing this?
It does introduce, about a couple of hours in, it introduces a reason for Michael to have to do the things he needs to do.
Yeah.
And it is entirely his own fault. And I have no sympathy for him whatsoever.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You know, he gets himself in trouble, but only by being a huge dick. Like, it's not a tragic thing, you know what I mean? And not that every story needs to go the same way.
But Franklin's actually the worst, because he's, in some ways, the least objectionable character. But also the one with the clearest path to not doing any of this stuff that he clearly hates doing.
Yeah.
And you're sitting there hearing him complain about how he hates the gang life, etc. And you're like, why am I doing this then?
Yeah, and it raises this question of, who the fuck am I?
Yeah.
Like,
the person forcing him to do it.
Yeah, exactly. Some malevolent fucking djinn coming in and controlling these people.
My thing is, it undermines doing the gangster stuff, but also, certainly, I know I'm going to have to do the gangster stuff. I know it's never going to be taken out of the game. It's always going to be compulsory. And so, sitting through the complaining about it is just a wall, just harrowing. Just shut up! I know I'm going to have to do it. I don't need to know how reluctant you are.
It's interesting in a way, because I realised something while I was thinking about this, that, like, you know, everyone talks about, you know, like Bethesda RPGs have their stock opening, and it's actually kind of important to those RPGs. There's always like the tunnel mouth moment or the cave mouth moment.
Yeah,
where it happens in Fallout, it happens in Skyrim, it happens in Oblivion, it happens in everything.
Really janky cutscenes, you know.
Yeah, you talk to a potato, and then you step out of a doorway, and you go, "Wow!" That's how all of those games start. And sometimes the potato is Liam Neeson.
If only we could talk to the potatoes.
Exactly. You can. Thanks, Todd Howard. Right, but. But the point is, you have that moment where, you know, they always have this stock opening. Like, in Elder Scrolls, it's always you're a prisoner. They kind of had a variant on that with the vault in Fallout 3. But it's always like, you're a prisoner, you escape, you're given the world and told you can go and do what you want. And actually, I realised, playing GTA 5, which breaks it, that Rockstar had exactly the same thing.
Hmm.
Rockstar have the opening where your character arrives in a vehicle to a new city or a new landscape, in the case of Red Dead Redemption, that is kind of theirs, but not theirs yet. So you always have, it's Niko Bellic arriving by boat, like GTA 4's intros is great. Mm. GTA 3 and Vice City, the protagonist arrives by plane, the first scene is them stepping out of the plane at the airport. You know, the beginning of Red Dead is this amazing scene setting train ride through the countryside.
San Andreas, I think you just arrived back in town, haven't you?
Yeah, you've just gotten back in town, which is kind of exciting, you have a pre-history with it. But that is their stock opening, or it was. And it serves to deliver a lot of stuff, but also serves to establish who you are in relation to it creates a really simple point of connection between you and whatever dickhead you're playing.
Yeah.
build that connection with you and the dickhead.
Because at least the one thing you have in common is that you're experiencing the city kind of for the first time together, right?
Yeah.
Within the opening moments of GTA 5, you control three different people. You skip time, and there's like I'm kind of paraphrasing myself from a thing I wrote today, but this isn't a kind of important distinction. The opening has like a kind of what the hell just happened twist in it that it's not going to explain for a long time, which further distances you from the characters you're controlling. So you're controlling three of them. Mm. They all have deep roots in the place that you're just encountering for the first time as a player. And those roots are really important in different ways. And so it's on those characters to explain themselves to you constantly. Mm. Like, it's got far more exposition than previous games did, because you have to find out kind of what Franklin's been up to, or what Michael's deal is, and how his life has gone. And it's on those characters. And so you have this weird thing where, even though technically you control Michael, you only really find out what the deal is with Michael when another character tells Michael.
Right. Yeah.
Even though Michael clearly knows. And so this is a car journey where one character's going, "Well, I know you did this, and then you did this, and then you did this." Well, Michael goes, "Yes. Those are the
pertinent..." I was there for those times.
It is more dramatic to reveal those pertinent backstory details now as opposed to earlier when they happened to me. Like, and it's clumsy, and it just, like, yeah.
Do you think...
That kind of the same thing is done much better slightly later when you play as Trevor, and you're on the drive into the city, and you've got Wade with you, and Trevor tells this, like, really clumsily tells this fairy tale story that's basically about him and Michael and how it all went down, and it's just... the hatred and everything that's gone on, and he tells it in this clumsy way to his subordinate in a way that's like completely believable to his character and makes complete sense, and they just kind of happens over and over again, but that's a good way of doing it as opposed to the way you describe
it. Sure, like, and the thing is, like, I kind of don't dwell on this because I kind of get to the point where I really, really like the game,
right?
Because there is stuff that I'd really, really love about it that's been like a huge delight to discover, but this was my frustration at the beginning of the game, I guess, was like, this just hits you in the face with, like, this is really fucking clumsy. And it's also like, it really wants to be a crime film, but it doesn't really get crime films because of the nature of the thing. And ludonarrative dissonance, sorry, is the oldest, you know, oldest thing in the book now. But, you know, crime movies are about, like, the fragility of power, really, fundamentally.
Hmm.
Like, you pick a crime movie, really, regardless of whether your main character starting at the top or at the bottom. You know, the traditional, and it's not, and whichever direction that arc takes, the fragility of life relative to the power you gather. This is true of Game of Thrones as well, which has elements of this too as well. It's always like, it's all, you know, it's tragedy. It's like classical tragedy in huge ways. It's like you have all of this and you can lose it at the moment's notice. And this is the terrible thing you've got to do to maintain it. And those are the core dramatic ideas of the movies that Rockstar apes. But the game itself is the absolute opposite of that. It's a game that's fundamentally about going up a very, very steady curve of completely rock-solid power.
Yeah.
Like, that you will never lose, that will never be threatened. And GTA 5 complicates that even further by starting different characters at different points on that curve.
Mm.
And then kind of, you know, so like, you know, Michael has far more money than Franklin, that kind of thing. And then just kind of saying, deal with that, and it saps all the dramatic irony of the thing, because there's really no reason to care about anything.
I wonder if this is why they put in things that they know are cliches, like you're this successful former gangster and your wife sleeping with her tennis coach, and they know it's a cliche and they put it in as a cliche without any further commentary or doing anything with it. But I think they just want to be a crime film, and they've seen that in crime films, and so they feel like doing something that's cliche in crime films is a big check on the box. It's like, yes, we've done it.
Yeah.
We've mimicked that motif without any actual...
The most charitable way of kind of interpreting it is to see the game as kind of like Crime Hero, whereas Guitar Hero would be like,
right.
Where you kind of, where the, I mean, not the new Guitar Hero that just announced, which looks atrocious, but like the old ones where it's like, this is a cartoon simulacra of an experience you might kind of fancy from watching music videos, watching concerts or whatever. And we know it's not real, but we're going to, you know, we're going to do the silly giant Satan guitars and everything else. And you kind of, you'll just ape it for a bit and it'll be fine. And it'll be fun. Because it's a game. And GTA used to be that. And it still is, really. It is kind of like, yeah, of course that would be what would happen if I was really this middle-aged gangster. I'm just going to kind of, you know, basically the answers don't think about it too much. But the
yeah,
it's too late for that, for one thing, and for the other thing is that they spent so much money and technology and effort and skill getting these actors in and getting the performances realized in such a substantial way that like sixth form review Scorsese is you kind of like, they don't have an obligation to do more with it, but it's like, holy shit, if no one else is going to do it, it could be you.
The trouble is, it's one of the few games that's broken into the mainstream sphere, and it then at that point it becomes a kind of ambassador for all gaming, and it comes under criticism for not being, you know, not standing up to film criticisms and not standing up to every form of criticism that can possibly come at it. And you know, Rockstar have never, the social commentary has always been dumb and full of Wii jokes. You know, it's always had jetpacks, it's always had batshit stuff. And they're kind of still doing the same thing, but people are, like, expecting more of them.
Hmm. I think they expect more of themselves as well. Like, GTA 4 was intentionally a kind of move towards some sort of, you know, gravitas and more somber realisation of the city and crime.
It does want to make you care. Like, I don't think they expend that much effort. I don't think you can say the whole thing is ironic, because when it is trying to be ironic, you really fucking tell.
Yeah.
Like, because it really does go for it. And on that, like, the stuff that's always been funny about GTA, like the talk radio stations and the news and the stuff, is presented in higher detail with far more of it. And you can go and watch surrealist Italian parody films and stuff if you want and all that kind of thing.
One of my favourite lines from your impressions piece was the point where you're unsure whether you hate the vapidity and kind of pointlessness of the characters or whether you just hate LA.
Yeah.
Is it funny? I don't know, does that for you excuse it if you could just hang it on?
There are parts of it that does, and I might write something subsequently about this, not in the review, because this is a much bigger topic.
Yeah.
But like, I read a great article, and I've totally forgotten the name of the author because it was linked to me on Twitter, about LA recently. And it was impressions of LA from someone who grew up on the East Coast. And it's very funny. It's just a funny skewering of LA. It's fish in a barrel, really. But, you know, LA opens itself to being skewered as just a void, I think is the way it's described. It's, you know, LA doesn't really care who you are or what you are, it just lets you kind of be in a way that no other city on earth kind of allows you to just sort of be.
It doesn't make it kind of satisfying to be a protagonist within that environment, probably.
Because LA itself, you know, is so malleable, you know, it's a series of motorways pretending to be a city. Like, you know, and the game does a phenomenal job in its environmental design and everything else of evoking that. And also in a lot of its parody, like, it's parody of Facebook and stuff like that, is consciously silly, but on point enough to be genuinely funny. Like, there's a skit, if when you go and visit the Facebook offices, or Life Invader is what it's called in GTA. Yeah.
Subtle.
Yeah, where you can walk straight past this if you're not paying attention to it, but there's a potential new hire who's shown up for a job interview, and he says, like, and someone says, you know, take a seat, like, feel free to try one of our bean bags. He's like, oh, I've actually got a really bad back. I'm just going to have a normal chair if that's okay. And he's like, no. Sat on a beanbag. And you just listen to him in pain on a beanbag for, like, as long as you want to stand there. And it's, like, stuff like that is great. Like, and when its sights are set on stuff like that, it really works. The problem is really that it either dehumanizes the ambitions of its central characters to the point of where nothing they do will care about merely don't give a shit because they become vapid LA, you know, people and also movie cliches. And so why give a shit about anything that happens to them? The other thing is that the lens of that criticism, that the view of LA isn't open enough. And this is something that I have to fucking figure out how I'm going to write about because I know exactly the kind of worms that's going to result from this.
Mm.
But it is a
specifically, like, male-centric or phallocentric criticism of LA. Like, one of its favourites...
I don't think that's a controversial position. I'm sure if you said that on Twitter, nobody would have any kind of response
and
to
it. And I don't think it's even an opinion. I think this is just, this is just like, critically provable. You know, if you look at where that game places its targets and what it says about different kinds of people, like, it's... So one of its favourite targets is, like, male midlife crises. Like, it loves to kind of, like, point at... You know, in the radio adverts for, like, you know, Viagra equivalents or all this stuff or whatever. You know, it's kind of like, it's all about men losing their edge or, and the kind of stupid shit they'll buy in order to prove themselves and whatever. And the story's a lot about that as well, because it's all men trying to prove themselves and recapture something or capture something for the first time. And Michael proving himself to Franklin and Franklin proving himself to Michael. And it's all this kind of like male crisis is the theme of the story, which is fine in terms of character motivation for individual characters, but it's basically the entire motivation of the world. To the point the women are exclusively presented in the part I've played as either players in that drama or total cartoons of one form or another. They're either, you know, vapid obstacles or they're vapid goals. And that's not really a political view of the game. It's just a kind of, it's the point where it's not like LA.
Right.
Because women go to LA and have their lives ruined. As well, right?
Yeah.
Like, that's one of the LA stories is, you know, like, or the archetypal narratives is that. You know, if your goal was to skewer the, you know, the culture of that part of California, that would be included in it. And it's pointedly absent. Or where it's presented in a, in the kind of...
It's a more facile view of that situation.
It's a facile, but it's also still a male-centric view of it. It's Michael's daughter getting, you know, flirting with the edges of the porn industry and stuff, and his kind of right as a father to kind of step in and stop that from happening. And it's... I don't necessarily expect everything from the game. I think Tom's completely right. I don't expect everything from it, but...
There is a problem, though, when you're presenting a world, like you say. I mean, if it was just a, fiction... with a kind of completely linear narrative like in a book or a movie, then it's fine to kind of appropriate just singular topics and look at them and investigate them. But when there's such a fidelity given to the environment and the things that you can do in it, I suppose it does create an expectation of there being a more kind of...
Yeah.
But wouldn't that create a new kind type of dissonance where the world was actually this really, like, reasoned place, then surely the characters you have who are these cartoon stereotypes would seem even more ridiculous.
Yeah. I think it just needs a little bit more balance. Like, it's...
It wouldn't be terribly hard for them to do that, given the amount of bunny pockets that they dug into.
Like, it needs them, I think, maybe to resist the really obvious low-hanging fruit when it comes to, like... I mean, because... You shouldn't even have to say this. There are shitloads of weird stereotypes of dudes in there. But there are lots and lots of ugly stereotypes of women, and it very rarely subverts those stereotypes. They're just sort of presented without comment. The spoiled, you know, Beverly Hills housewife. Presented without comment, the crazy, quote-unquote, feminist. Presented without comment, the girl in the clothes store who is mean. And where the male characters are afforded a bit of depth, weird, like, journeys through their own stereotypeness. So, you know, Franklin is the young gangbanger with a heart of gold kind of thing, and Michael is the retired bank robber with, you know, kind of like a strange protectiveness of his family and whatever.
Even the NPCs, actually, like the FIB contact Michael has is like a proper person who, like, he has reasons for why he's doing the shit he's doing, and, you know, that's more than it's afforded to.
Yeah, and weirdly, like, the only other defense you could offer of it is, well, this is not the world, this is the world through the eyes of the person you're controlling.
Yeah.
This is how Michael sees his family, it's not necessarily a family, it's necessarily his. That doesn't work when there are three points of view. So, rapidly moving on, because I realise I've gone about that, and that's a tricky subject to unpick. But the point is, I got through the single player, and I was like, and arguably the more serious criticism of the single player is you don't really do very much in it. You drive from point to point and watch cutscenes, and your interactions are mostly shoot the man.
I've been impressed. I had a really good time with some of the heists, a little bit later on. Like,
I've gone to the start of them now.
Yeah, that's the time when actually calling it, you know, calling in all those movie cliches really fucking works. Like, looking at the board with all the plans on and getting to choose whether you want to do the quiet thing or the loud thing. And then the switching between characters, you know, all you get to play all the cool bits of a heist movie. And that fantasy is intact in those impressive missions.
It's also pointedly intact in online. And this is kind of where the game opened up for me completely. So it's actually called GTA Online, not GTA 5 multiplayer or whatever, and it loads, you can load it from within the main game, and it's the same engine and the same everything else, but it's sort of treated like a separate game in some ways.
Hmm.
And it's fucking great. And if I was reviewing GTA Online, the standalone game that was just an online-only thing, a few technical issues aside, I would have been raving about it for the last however long it's been. Like, it's... Okay, so I get the impression it didn't work on console, which is why people don't talk about it much. And it's only got the heist stuff recently, as far as I know. But the package you got on PC is basically a kind of mini-RPG that's intended to be... Mini-MMO, sorry, that's intended to be played with friends. It gives you the whole open world to play in, the chance to create your own character who's a silent protagonist who arrives by plane, pointedly. The intro is so much like the intro to GTA 3 that it's kind of interesting that it works way better. And it's really gamey. It's much gamier. You have XP bars and you level up, and you level up your different skills by doing those things. So you can go running to improve your stamina and all that kind of thing. And it all fits together really well. And it feels just like a video game. Like a really, really good video game. And it has cutscenes and stuff, but they all serve the fantasy of being a criminal, and they're much lighter touch than the single player ones, because your character doesn't speak. So it's just you kind of nodding and receiving missions from people. But the world feels like it's open to you, and that there are multiple paths you can take through it in a way that's simply not the case in the single player game. You know, your first goals will be to like have a car, upgrade your car, maybe get enough money to buy an apartment and stuff like that. And to do that, you'll stick up shops by pointing your gun at the shopkeeper and yelling through your microphone to get them to fill the bag faster. You can use your phone, talk to other players. You can actually phone other players and talk to them on the phone, which is strange that that's how it works. Like, I phoned my friend and I didn't know that's what would happen. And I don't know what I was expecting. Like, I was expecting to take him to a lobby or something, but no, it's just a phone. So I started off, and like, you know, after you're off the plane, you get taken by one of the characters in the single player campaign for a street race, and it just loads other players into your street race. And after that, you get sent to pick up some drugs and you get into a fight, and other players will join onto that as well. And it works phenomenally, especially with the first-person mode. It's like the most detailed MMO you've ever seen in terms of the fidelity of the world and the characters and everything else. And
it's first-person mode new?
It's in the PC and the next-gen version, so it's been in the version that came out in November as well. But it's stunning. Like,
yeah.
And it's got, you know, it can be a bit wonky technically, but I haven't had too many problems. I think Graham has, from what I've read of his. But, like, yeah, it's for me, it's been okay. But for me also specifically, I've been playing with a group of friends that we all sit on Skype together or use on game chat and hang out together. And I don't want to go back to single player now. Like, it's been the most fun I've had with a multiplayer game in a long, long, long time. And it's all like systems driven and based on the amount of choices you have the freedom to make.
Tell us about the heist, man.
That's what I'm going to say. So the other thing is, you have these heists and they're like single player campaign. Mm. In the one player, a player has to have a certain kind of apartment with the heist room in it. Which is where you plan your heists, and be a certain level to start the heist, but everyone else can join. You form a crew of four people, and heists are basically these narrative kind of things. You get given missions by a handler, but they're divided into three or four prep missions that you can do in any order, followed by like a finale. And they're all different, and they're all basically like co-op missions, but they're hugely asymmetrical. And that asymmetry is used. So where in the single-player campaign you get to play all the cool parts of a heist, this is cool because you get to do one part of a heist, and it's on you. And you get to see your friends doing the other parts of it. And it's this perfect realization of that fantasy where, you know, like, and in some cases it will just set, it'll divide you into two teams of two and send you off into completely different sides of the open world to do completely different things, but you'll still hear each other on the radio. Kind of, you share a single pool of lives for your entire team. You can get reset to the start if you fail. But you're all kind of, you know, solving your tasks in however way you see fit within the context of your individual teams. And the different tasks make it more replayable, but they also create this really cool sense that, like, that you're actually doing a caper. Like, I think games have really struggled to capture that feeling. Like, you know, the first Payday definitely did. I didn't play too much of the second Payday. That feeling, like, you're doing this kind of precarious thing that requires lots of different things going right. And just by splitting the team up, it achieves that really, really well. So two of you might be stealing a car in one part of the city, while two of you pose as police officers and infiltrate the police station somewhere else. And once one of your tasks is done, the pair that finish first are free to go and help the other pair, which leads to, like, you know, two people escaping in a car, desperate to lose the cops, when the other team that finished early comes barreling out of nowhere to save them or whatever. Or it leads to me, like, in the finale of the heist we did, as the pilot, just idling on a runway in a plane, completely helpless, as the rest of the team tries to flee the police to get to my plane in time to escape. And I'm just sat there on a desert runway, idling the engine with the door open, just waiting and going, come on, guys, come on, guys, come on, guys, watching their van, like, approach a cloud of smoke from the distance with helicopters chasing it. Watching, like, the chase across the runway as they get in, and then just, like, I have one job. And, like, I'm not interacting with the game much, but, like, I'm literally just waiting and then pressing accelerate and taking off and trying not to fuck it up. But, like, if you compare the simple interactions of the single player, you know, walk into the light, watch the cutscene, walk to the other place, watch the cutscene, with that simpler interaction of just wait and take off, it's so much more dramatic and it feels way more personal. And, like, the score you get for the heist was, relative to the amount of money I could make from doing anything else in the game, massive. Like, it allowed me to buy, like, the highest tier of house, like, almost straight away. Not the very highest, but, like, to get onto the property ladder in a big way and, like, really get out of my car. And it felt like cheating at life. You know that fantasy in, like, the fantasy of crime is you get to skip ahead at life. Yeah, like, I'm rich now. And, like, the heist ends with this scene of your characters all clinking champagne glasses and cheering. Like, and it actually felt like that. And we all went to the tattoo parlour and all got matching tattoos to commemorate the first heist. And we're going to be doing the second one now. And the second one has some amazing stuff in it as well. There's five of them, I think. That one took us a whole evening to do. And it was fucking great. Like, just a whole game of that. I would happily just extol the praise of it all the time. And yet, they've managed to make this really complex and problematic cultural thing of what should just be the best co-op heist game ever made.
Imagine if their entire budget was just dedicated to creating those experiences.
They do need to iron out some netcode things, but, like, I've had so many experiences with already that you couldn't have in any of the game. Like, we went out into the desert after that to get that tattoo, and afterwards we went back to my friend's house, and there were, like, drinking stations where you can stand and drink constantly. And my friend Dan got hammered. Really, really hammered, and he rode a bicycle out there, and he couldn't ride his bike anymore. He was so pissed.
We're still talking about the game.
Exactly. And so I said, Dan, just get in my car. Because I was sober, because I hadn't drunk. And so he got into my muscle car, kind of like still swaying. And I drove him back to Los Santos and dropped him off at his front door. I was like, just go to fuck to bed. And then I drove home. And, like, there was nothing GTA-ish about that. It was just, like, the systems all collided in a way that created this really natural little story of, like, obviously you could have logged off and logged back on later in his apartment or whatever, but there's this kind of nice feeling of him sobering up in the passenger seat as I kind of just drive us back through the beautifully rendered desert. When it works, it's so much better. I don't think it works if you don't play it with friends. I think you should definitely play it with people that want to play it with you. But it's just little things, like being able to flip people off is hilarious. Being able to take selfies and use the camera phone is amazing. Because when someone, like, crashes their car and is trying to extract it from a lamppost, or falls over, which does happen quite a lot, the thing that's most infuriating is seeing another player taking a picture on their phone. And, like, I've seen friends punch friends because, like, don't fucking take a picture! it's so good. It takes what was already technically accomplished about that game and gives it life in a way that's really, really fucking good. Damn it, I've got to finish the single-player campaign before I review it. I really don't want it.
I just started playing as the third character, and I hated everything about it, and all of the cutscenes, and all of the story, and him, and everything about the entire area, and I'm not allowed to switch back to the other two characters anymore.
Oh, yeah.
There's obviously a certain amount I have to do as this guy, and at that point, I just got sick of it and stopped.
It feels like, as a package, like £40 for this thing that...
Oh, shit, I'd pay that for the experience I've had with the multiplayer so far. Like, and I get that, actually, I really should caveat with people have had connection issues and stuff. I haven't had too many. It has some weird bugs still, and it can kind of be a bit slow to matchmake, but I've always been able to find my friends and do this stuff, and just tooling about is great. Like, and there's some amazing, amazing, really, really awkward mini-games they put there on purpose. Like, you can get reputation points from singing in the shower in your apartment. But if someone has an open mic on, everyone on the server will hear that. So good.
I've mostly just been... I've not tried the online stuff yet, and I've done some of the story stuff, but I've mostly just been looking around. And it is, like Chris touched on it, but it's fucking extraordinary. That place is absolutely ridiculous on PC. But every texture, every surface reacts differently to you if it gets kicked or shot. Like the way that puddles ripple in the rain, you know, the way that the type of dirt that is kicked up by your motorbike changes depending on the surface you ride over. Like the kind of integrity of that place is unlike anything else I've seen in games. It is really extraordinary. And I will play through the single player stuff, but just to get more toys with which to fuck with that space. That this incredible space, everywhere you go looks extraordinary. The art direction, I think, is outstanding. In the way that it presents this realistic place, but just about just has this caricature for the people that live within it, this kind of just slightly caricatured, the way their faces are drawn, the way they look and dress, that works absolutely perfectly. And hitting that balance must be, it's just so hard. Mm. And they've just nailed it. It's just fantastic. And it's also, I think of GTA as being like this delicious pop culture sandwich. And the radio stations alone are absolutely fantastic. Not just the track list, but they've got like Lotus Flower to do a fucking set. And like, he's a big part of LA kind of electronic stuff. Mm. And even that is just a nod to that place. And you can listen to that and just cruise. And that alone is, I love that. I absolutely love it. But I place a lot of stock in just being in a game world.
Yeah.
That's a big part, a big valuable thing for me. And I think GTA 5 just gives me an amazing hit.
Yeah. I like, walking around in first person is such a huge advantage for that game. No one else is doing it, really. Mm. Like, I had to, like, when I started playing, I had the graphics settings higher than I do now, and I was getting, like, 25, 30 frames a second. I've since turned them down so I can get 50, which just feels more comfortable. Mm. And I kind of miss it, because it does, you know, when it starts to get uglier up close pretty quickly. But it's still, it's so hard to, like, it feels like a huge paradigm shift in how good games can look in a way, or how detailed they can be. Mm. It's almost hard to describe, because it's like, you're so used to, your mind glosses the things that get, the corners that games cut all the time, where it's like, of course, this interior is the same as this interior, or this building is going to be a copy, you know, cut and paste of a building elsewhere on the map, or something like that. That encountering a game which is so kind of bespoke feeling and kind of crafted is either it's extraordinary half the time, and then it passes into just, you just accept it, because, well, that's what real life is like. And so it passes through the kind of barrier into, like, well, of course there's, you know, a unique milk carton on the edge of this table.
Even the way they render bushes is insane. And I'm not going to get too far into this, but because
that's the render bush.
Incredibly boring. But like, one of their bush types is just rendered using dots. There's a brilliant Reddit post about it, and it's just, when you actually push your face super fucking close into it, it's just dots, but like arranged in a kind of like voxel type pattern that looks absolutely just impeccable at a distance of 6 feet. And
no
then, and then other bushes are just normal textured things, and they've developed different techniques for different types of fucking bush. That's how ridiculous this game is.
I have this image of like a retired heist master Michael pushing his face into this voxel bush to say, look, it's made of dots.
It's like there's a moment last night, I was playing quite late, when I was just driving through the city at night in my cool tricked out car that I like, pretending to be Ryan Gosling in the movie Drive, when two players decided to chase me, and they could have shot me or whatever. Players do that, they can be dicks. But they chose to chase me while firing flare guns at me. And so they were firing flare guns over my car, and the flare gun acceleration is, the projectile acceleration is clearly tuned to be able to overtake a car that's driving ahead of the car that the flare gun's being fired from. Right. And M83 Midnight City was on the radio, and I'm driving through this LA at night as just flares fly over the roof of my car and like stick to the road and start lighting the way in front of me. And it was like, if this was happening in, like, this or something like this could be a set piece in, like, Gravity Bung. You know what I mean? Like, there's a kind of, like, this kind of beautifully constructed kind of moment. It doesn't really say anything. It's just kind of the image of the thing is beautiful. Mm. And it's like, this is happening because two dickheads are trolling me. And this has ended up extraordinary because someone programmed beautiful flares. Like,
you can make your own radio station by putting your own tracks into the right documents folder. And you can either choose to just have it just play through your playlist, or have they will wrap DJ banter around your tracks. GTA 4 did do this as well, in fairness, but just that is just absolutely brilliant.
I wonder if one way to kind of feel warmer towards GTA, given the kind of, because my coolness stems from the things it attempts to do in terms of film, really, and where it falls short of that. Mm-hmm. And there are really two ways of looking at it. Like, you can see, like, Rockstar's kind of cinematic stuff has always been kind of auteur-led, to say the least, right? That's the part of the studio where its reputation comes from, you know, singular kind of creative voices that are expressed through the writing and the stuff that is variously good and bad about it. So you can see it as this kind of individual, creative-led thing that has some really serious issues, but exists on top of this beautiful world with so many kind of amazing things in it. Or you can see it as a kind of slightly wonky auteur-led thing sitting on top of this amazing collective creative effort. Mm. And given the stories that have come out of Rockstar in the past of like how crunched, how brutal crunch can be at the various studios, or has been historically, That I think is the warmer way of thinking about it, like to kind of ignore the story stuff and the kind of the pointy writing for a bit and think, does a team or an individual that decided that this game was going to have just fucking brilliant reflections or flares or whatever feature it is, bushes. And the game itself is the sum of all of those smaller efforts, and it's this huge kind of like collective thing that the players then make their own in a lot of different ways. And I think the online mode is good because it's a little bit more open to being made your own from the start,
yeah,
rather than being put on the rails.
Yeah.
And that's kind of a much more pleasant way of thinking about it for me, I think, rather than thinking of it as this kind of, you know, shit Guy Ritchie movies.
I really appreciate that they haven't filled their online mode with loads of bullshit microtransactions or anything like that.
What?
Or have they? Oh, really?
So, actually, I'd forgotten to tell the story.
Oh, shit.
This is the single most depressing thing that's ever happened to me in a game.
Oh, no.
Okay, so, in order to explain this, I have to explain something quickly. Uh-huh. In GTA Online, you have money in the bank and money in your hands.
Hmm.
Money in the bank, if you have money in your hands above 5k, it can be stolen by players when you die. So you're encouraged to bank it. But in order to have money for illicit things, you need money in your hand. So you can buy houses and stuff with your banked money, but you can't buy, like, I don't know, like drugs or stuff. So the other thing is you can't pause. So you have to pull over if you want to use the map, because otherwise you'll crash, or someone will crash into you or shoot you.
Hmm.
So I pulled over to use the map at night in a dodgy part of town. And the game detected that because there were prostitutes sufficiently nearby that it needed to show me the pop-up tooltip for how to hire a prostitute if I wanted to. So it popped up the you can pay, you know, like it was like, you know, honk the horn if you want to buy sex. At that same moment, it detected that I didn't have any money because I had banked all my money, and prostitution is an illicit act, so it needs your cash in hand. And so detecting that I didn't have any money, it then subsequently popped up the tooltip for what happens if it detects that you don't have any money, which is if you'd like to buy some money with real money, press A or whatever. And it was like, in a single gesture, the game had introduced its most depressing feature, and then its second most depressing feature.
So to literally pay real money.
Yeah, exactly. It's like the notion that, you know, you're literally being confronted with a tooltip to pay $1.99 for space hookers. And that was like, so it's made like, so from the, and this was actually not long after being chased through the city with the flares and the moment of transcendent, indie pop beauty. It was then one of the ugliest things I'd ever seen. So, GTA, everybody.
What have you been playing, Tom?
Someone has to ask me. I can't just volunteer it. I've been playing a bunch of little things. Deadbolt was one of them. And the other two were Wildfire and Circa Infinity. Am I getting that right, Tom?
Yeah, that's right.
Because you posted about that today on PC Gamer.
I did, and I've yet to play the build that they sent over.
Oh, they send you on.
They did, yeah.
It's really good. So it's a... The guy described it to me as being like Super Hexagon as a puzzle platformer. And so it's concentric circles rather than concentric hexagons. And you are standing on... There's a lot in common with... if you ever played an indie game where you're running around on planets and jumping from one planet to the next, it's a bit like that, only all of the planets are concentric. And they're either black or white, alternating. And when you're on a white planet, you're black. And I guess you're also white. I can't remember. you're standing on this black, almost white planet. And then when you get to a certain, like, region on it, a certain, like, particular location, then you can press space to flip into it. And then you're standing on the inside of it. And you're inside the white planet, and the white space is now empty and the black space is solid.
Right.
And then as you're doing that, every circle has in it a wedge that's the area in which you're allowed to flip between the two sides. And early on it's just flipping, and then you get these red enemies inside the circles who are just kind of initially just standing there, and then later on kind of marching around it. And they're weirdly drawn. They look a bit like sort of the enemy in Qbert, if anyone remembers that. Like sort of very ugly, crude, pixelated monsters. And they're the only red thing, everything else is black and white, and they are in circles, and they're often arranged in very geometric patterns. It reminds me a bit of a bullet hell shooter in the way that the enemies are arranged in a way that's both challenging and presents a certain solution in which you have to jump in a rhythmic way to get over them, but also geometrically pleasing and very symmetrical and all that stuff. And they're also rotating most of the time, and the different concentric circles are rotating in different directions, and they all have different arrangements of enemies. And so it makes this amazing, like, kaleidoscope effect. Like, looking into it, it's sort of like something between a kaleidoscope and also weirdly reminds me of, like, traditional Chinese art, like sort of the very stark colours and these meticulous patterns that are all really beautiful and symmetrical, and kind of concentric circles is a big thing in a lot of Chinese cultural art. And they are so like visually amazing, but like in some ways doubly impressive because all of the visuals come from the actual functional elements of the level. Nothing is there for purely aesthetic reasons. All of that beautiful pattern that you're seeing was actually challenges that you got past or challenges that you're still to face within the circles. And it sort of tasks you with things like, I've just got to a world where you're going to keep going into these rings, then you get to the centre and there's a kind of portal there and that takes you to the next chapter. And between the chapters there's little narrative bits that don't really work. If you remember the narrative bits from Braid, imagine that. But more on the nose. But I mean, to be honest, I've only seen like three of them, so I don't really know where they're going. But it, like, the rest of it is so surreal and so batshit that the fact that there's a narrative trying to get context to it fell out of place to me. I kind of wanted it to just be surreal and batshit. I've just got to a world where you get to the wedge part of the circle where you can flip through, and it's completely guarded by enemies on the other side. And so if you flip through, you die. So, and there's nowhere else you can flip through. But periodically, those enemies flip through themselves. They come from the inner circle and go to the outer circle. And as they're flipping, you can also flip at the same time, and then you don't hit them. You kind of exchange places. So the whole thing becomes a kind of a rhythmic thing of just waiting till they're going to flip. And as soon as they're going to flip, you have to flip in. And that's fine at first. And then you get into the inner circles where that's happening. And also within that circle, there's like flying enemies, so you can't jump over certain enemies, and patrolling enemies, so as soon as you get through, you're going to be in danger immediately from someone walking into your place, and you can't jump over him yet because there's a flying guy, so you've got to run in another direction, and then you can't run too far in that direction, and that kind of stuff. And if you die, you kind of get set back to, you get set back one ring, so you kind of go back to the outer planet. And it, like, I didn't get anywhere with Super Hexagon because it was way too time sensitive. It was just brutally, brutally twitch based, and I just don't have the kind of skill you need for that. And I get frustrated very easily. And I thought that might happen with this because watching the trailer, it shows what must be some, certainly some stuff from further into the game that I've got to, and it looks like a nightmare. It's like, looks spectacular. You want to play it because it looks so cool, but it also looks so, so hard. And I was pleasantly surprised that the game's actually intuitive and leads you in very gently, and there's lots of first few levels are just very manageable. And if it's going to have a hard level, there's going to be 8 easy levels before it rings, you know. Levels perhaps a bit charitable because it's like literally 10 seconds to do them. And often, this is a weird thing actually, for something that feels like a puzzle game where it's trying to introduce mechanics, there'll be a ring where they're teaching you that, oh, you need to jump over these enemies, and then a ring where you need to get past these moving enemies, and then there'll just be like 2 or 3 more rings where you just have to get past the moving enemies again, and it's the exact same challenge, just shrunk a little bit, and it doesn't sort of teach you anything new, and it's just kind of giving you a bit of space, like a bit of breathing room to like, okay, you've done it, but just check, you can definitely do it, because you're going to need to do this like in your sleep. And that works pretty well.
It's an easy one to post about, because sometimes it just showed the game just in its raw state for a start, which I'd just all trailers should do that.
Yeah.
And it didn't fuck around with like logos and stuff. It was just, here is the game. Yep. I was like, and sometimes if you play those games, I think you could just instinctively tell when something's going to be satisfying to manipulate, and just seeing him bounce through those circles just looked immediately brilliant. And also it went brilliantly with the music and that rhythmic thing.
So
you said. I was like, again, that reminded me of Suits of Hexagon as well. The music and the shapes and the way that they move and come at you. That is all part of this cool aesthetic, man.
It's a really, really good trailer. The guy emailed me just kind of just to send me a build and ask me what I thought. That happens sometimes, and it's usually I'm often half afraid it's going to be horrible because then I don't know what to say. And there are lots and lots of horrible games out there. That's just a fact of life. Lots of people who, you know, just tried their first game ever and don't know what the hell they're doing and have made something, and it's great that they're trying, but they haven't got anywhere yet. And so at every stage, this was just a breath of fresh air. Like, when I watched the trailer, I was like, not only does this game look really cool, but this trailer is really well done, because it's just showing me the game, and the music goes so well with it, and it shows it simply enough at first that not only does it look cool, but you get what the concept is. You can see how you play it, you see what you do in the game. The concept itself, the concept kind of sells itself. You can see it just from a trailer, like, oh, that's why this is cool. Oh, that, so it leads to this kind of thing. And then it escalates to the point where it's stuff that where you can't track what's going on, because at one point he's controlling two different people in different worlds, and they both have to avoid different sets of enemies. And then it kind of escalates, and it escalates with the music, and just looks really cool. And then actually playing it, it turned out to be really fun. So just kind of hitting it on all.
If you're a new developer, like, and you want to get featured on a website, then that's pretty good trailer to look at in terms of, you know, how to present your game in its raw form and make it look cool.
How did you hear about it, by the way? Because I got the credit for you covering it. You said, oh, I just saw it covered on PC Gamer. I guess that was your doing.
Oh, no. I can't remember. Like, there was a news at me, so I was just trawling through forums.
It's a dream.
It came to me in a wonderful, musical, concentric dream. I don't know. It's just like, if there's any news, you just go through those forums and then try and find cool stuff. Can't remember precisely where it was.
Kenny Sun is the name of the guy who makes it.
Good stuff.
And, sorry, just quickly, the other one was Wildfire, which was a game by the Sneaky Bastards, who, that's a stealth game magazine that was funded on Kickstarter. It's kind of like a PDF thing. I think there was physical copies as one of the backer rewards, but primarily a digital thing. And they just cover stealth games, and so they're really into, you know,
stealth games.
Splinter Cell and, Dishonored is their, I think, their, main obsession. And they're now making a game called Wildfire, which is a side-on stealth game about fire propagation. So it's kind of like, I think, a little bit inspired by Far Cry 2. And you are a sort of thief-type character, and you sneak through tall grass, and there's medieval guards patrolling, and when you're in tall grass, they can't see you, and you're silent. And you can... There's fires burning around in various places, and you can kind of steal the fire. From almost any range, if you can see the fire, you can suck a ball of fire out of it into your hand and then throw it wherever you like, and it will set fire to whatever it hits. And you can't, weirdly, set fire to the enemies. It's a game completely about fire propagation in which you can't set fire to the enemies, at least not directly. Like, if you throw a fireball at them, it just goes straight through them and doesn't hit them at all. But if you set fire to the grass, then they will see it, and even if they're not actually being burnt by it, they will see it, you know, from away and just run in the opposite direction. And so it's about kind of using that to trick them into running off ledges or running into water. And you can also pick up water to put out the fire. And then weirdly, you can throw water back at water, and that freezes the water.
So I don't know, you make double water. Yeah.
Double water is ice, I guess.
Half water is air. Water is water, and then
and
double anti-water
is
ice.
Fire. Yeah. Or anti-double water, I guess.
No, water is anti-fire.
Oh, yeah.
So your double anti-fire is ice.
What is anti-ice?
Anti-freeze.
there's a free alpha that you can play right now. There's a Kickstarter going on right now. It's promising. The alpha that's out there, the tutorial of it works, and there's bits, very prescribed puzzles where it's like, okay, there's a person here, there's some grass there, there's a drop there, you set fire to the grass, the person runs off the drop and dies, and that's great. And then once it tries to open up, I started to not have those moments, and I couldn't. Maybe there were really clever solutions that are really satisfying, but I was just sort of, it would be like there'd be two different layers, and I'm trying to take the top one, and there's grass up there, and there's archers up there, and there's like 10 soldiers down the bottom, and there's a wooden bridge, and you could set fire to the bridge, but it seems like the only way that's useful, the only way to get past this archer is wait for him to patrol over the bridge, and then when he turns around, like set fire to the bridge, so that he can't get across it, but then to get across it yourself, you kind of have to run through the fire you just created. And I kept almost every puzzle I'd get through it, but it would be this really messy solution. I'd be sprinting through flames that I'd caused to get out.
Do you get hurt by the flames?
Yeah, but really, really slowly.
Right.
And it makes a big deal of it. Like, as soon as you go in flare, it really flashes red. Like, oh, God, don't do this, don't do this.
Oh, really? Because in the trailers heavily have you running through fire all the time. So I assumed you were just impervious to it, if you're some kind of fire mage, I don't know.
Well, you almost are. I had a bit where... I just fucked it up completely. I'd set fire to a bridge, and then I'd run through it, and then people were shooting at me, and so I just had to throw myself into another fire, and I just couldn't get away from the fire at all, and I spent so long in the fire that I caught fire myself. Like, you can spend 2 or 3 seconds in fire before you even catch fire, and then when you catch fire, you're still not dead. And then as you like it surely teaches you, you can set yourself on fire and then run at a bunch of guards, and they're so terrified of fire that they run away from you, and that's fine as long as you're going to get to some water eventually. And in the tutorial, it's like 2 seconds later, and it makes sense. But in this situation, I just set myself on fire, I'd set everything else on fire, I was running past guards, everyone was seeing me, I was no stealth at all. And then I kind of jumped over a bunch more people, set fire to a bunch more things, and then actually there's a little bit of water right at the end of the level, and so like 5 or 6 seconds later, I'd get to the water and put myself out and then complete the level. I was like, was that success? Did I win? That seems weird. And obviously there are better ways to do it. That's not the actual solution to that level. But I feel like there's something I'm missing, like there's some way to use the fire in some clever way that I haven't got yet. Because if there's a bit of grass and a sheer drop, I know how to solve that. And if there's not a sheer drop, I just have no clue. I'm just like, well, I guess, I mean, I can play it as a traditional stealth game, I just sneak past, but then why is the fire?
Why is the fire?
It looks like a cool game about manipulating AI from the trailer I saw, like in terms of using fear of fire to move people around.
It's interesting that they're terrified of fire, but they're invulnerable to fire.
Yeah, it's sort of ironic.
Yeah.
I think, I haven't seen it happen yet, but I imagine if they get trapped by fire, like between a wall and some fire, they probably eventually catch light, like you do. Mm. But fireballs themselves don't touch them. I tried, also enemies with torches, and like night levels. So they're walking around with torches, and you think, one source of light, and I have the power over fire, so I'll suck their torch away. And you realize I just sucked the fire from their torch to me. And previously they didn't know where I was. Now there's just this one big glowing guy.
It's the thief of your fire.
They can't see themselves now, but they can see me. So that's really the opposite of what I'm trying to achieve.
Right? So.
Well, I'm not on fire at that point, so I don't mind.
There's a really big important difference.
Yeah, it's like
contained and uncontained.
Fire in hands, attack. Fire on self. Do not
attack. That's such a specific phobia of fire.
Uncontrolled fire is terrifying.
Yeah. Very controlled fire, no worries.
Controlled fire just tells you to kill rooms full of zombies. Yeah.
They should have called it controlled fire instead of wildfire.
What have you been playing, Tom Senior?
Oh, just exclusively GTA Forever.
Yeah, it's putting my life on hold.
Yeah, I think so. I honestly can't remember any of the games I've been playing. I played it so much last night. I'm just all GTA.
Same, friend, same.
Mm.
Cool. Then shall we move on to questions from questions?
Let's do that.
Stephen Malone writes in to say, "Evening, gents! I recently started replaying the director's cut of Deus Ex Human Revolution, which includes an excellent commentary by the game's writers and developers, which we talked about last week, I think, briefly.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of using the Half-Life 2-style commentary, usable nodes in the game...
No usable node.
Thanks, man. It just prompts you to listen at certain points by pressing F whenever the commentary has something to say. If only I could press F to listen to you, Chris, and electively not press F most of the time. My question is... Do you enjoy commentary in games? Says a man who clearly didn't listen to our last podcast. Wow. If so, what system of commentary do you prefer? And what are some other examples of great commentaries? I like that games are so interactive that even their commentary systems can be analysed and critiqued. Stephen Malone.
I'm going to self-promote here and say that Gunpoint has a developer commentary that you can listen to if you have a special edition or above. And we did it
nodes?
By... I am a usable node. I'm literally a usable node. I am in the level.
You usable node.
John did a great sprite of each of us, himself, me, and the lead musician. And so you will see me in the level sometimes holding a spanner because I'm a programmer. And John is holding a paintbrush. And Ryan, the musician, I think he's got like a keyboard that he's holding and he's got headphones on. And you walk up to us and you talk to us like NPCs, and then we give you the commentary.
You can also on you and punch you to death.
You can shoot me to death. We didn't. I thought about letting you jump on me and punch me in the face. I thought about it hard, but the problem is that you jump around so much that it would actually be annoying. It would mean we would get in the way of you trying to jump on enemies and stuff. But I still let you shoot us because you don't shoot that much in the game.
I really like that delivery mechanism for commentaries, and I wish it was replicated in games like Dishonored, where perhaps. The outsider turns up and actually it's just Harvey Smith in a leather jacket. Say hello, I'm Wisdom of the Escape, help me.
I've been watching you, Cora. I found your actions very interesting in some weird way that I'll then spend 5 minutes explaining.
Man, if only you could jump on David Cage and punch him repeatedly during his career. I don't actually want to do that in real life, just to point that out. Millard. Any other commentaries that you've enjoyed?
Valve commentaries are very good. A lot of time, especially like their artists, I really like hearing about how for example, in Left 4 Dead, they deal with like silhouettes for the top of skylines and all the detail. Detail you really don't look at very much, and then you realise how much effort's gone into it. Really interesting.
Interesting effort that you maybe don't notice.
Yeah, commentaries.
In some ways, it's quite surprising that they... I mean, I feel like they kind of pioneered it. I don't know of a developer commentary before Valve did it.
Mm.
And yet, they're quite a closed company. They sort of... They go to great lengths to hide who did what most of the time. And they don't... Like, in the credits, everyone's just listed as just a member of Valve. And all of Valve apparently did every game. And they don't... I mean, lately they started a blog, but back then they really didn't talk about their process that much at all. And so it was weird that they kind of did this thing of... We're just going to tell you how we made all this stuff now.
Are you saying that Valve is sometimes whimsical or contradictory based on an internal logic that might not be entirely clear to an outside observer?
Yeah, that's more or less.
Okay. I enjoyed this, listening to their level design stuff as well. Like, their tutorial stuff is amazing, the way they try and guide you into certain behaviours. That's really cool.
So all of their games are contrary?
Portal definitely does. Left 4 Dead definitely does.
Half-Life 2 is just the episodes, isn't it?
Oh, it's just the episodes. Okay. Look up the giant, golden, floating, rotating speech bubbles.
Would you want a Dota 2 commentary?
I don't know how that would work.
It'd be quite distracting mid-match.
Yeah.
Well, I've got to...
Well, in this sequence, we thought maybe this guy needed to be more racist.
So we had him say...
Yeah, maybe it should be an announcement. Every time a tower falls, they give you a new little bit of...
Yeah,
people that actually could almost work. Not being stereotyped enough, so...
Oh, Witch Doctor.
Yeah,
you can almost blame Blizzard for that one.
Yeah, it's no better in HOTS.
And Diablo 3 as well, yeah.
I think if someone does a terrible thing and then you steal it in your own game, you're at least as responsible
actually,
for it being
like,
terrible.
Witch Doctor has some amazing puns, which would work independent of the accent they chose to give him. But yeah, no, it's still an issue.
I've got to figure out how to do it in a completely randomly generated game where I can't place...
I assume you're looking.
You mean?
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out extreme racism and heatsink.
How do we get an awful voodoo Caribbean stereotype into this game? Just about spaceships. I don't know
where to put space Haiti.
We added the giant rotating racism node.
Press E to racism.
That is basically a Star Trek original series.
Yeah.
They actually do encounter the fucking racist.
Why didn't I think of this? The racist race. Because that way all that race are the same. We can judge them as one.
Robbie Boyter writes in two questions to say, "Dear Questions, back when I was an obnoxious teenage atheist, I once played through Civilization 2, refusing to research the most basic religious text, which I believe is polytheism. This caused a difficulty, since many other texts and buildings chain onwards from it. Also, even once I had developed an industrialized society with tanks, trains, and packaged goods, my science advisor was still advising me to check out that hot new polytheism. My question is this. Apart from moral choices and pacifist runs, have you ever played a game a certain way for ideological reasons? Did you face interesting difficulties or situations? All the best. Robbie Boyter from Toronto. Also, he says he's been listening for episode 1, but he still has difficulty telling the difference between Marsh and Thomas's voice. Just to clear it up, I am Tom Senior.
My name is Marsh Davis.
There you go. Yeah, that's sure I'll...
That's a joke.
It was the other way around.
After his story, I really want to know what texts do lead on from polytheism. What was he prevented from doing? Because it's impossible if you don't believe
pottery.
In enough gods.
You can't make pots.
It can't be done. What would you make pots of? Exactly. What do you put on the sides? I don't know. It has to be God.
They have no idea how to store like, the ammunition or rations for their tanks or whatever.
If only we had a basic religious framework, then we could store this ammo and
stuff. It's a hard sell to say that anything directly leads on from polytheism.
You were saying that it's a shame Graham wasn't on this podcast because...
He played Minecraft as a vegetarian. He wasn't allowed to kill pigs and things to like get their meat. And I think... I mean, probably these days every possible thing can be eaten, but I think back then it was difficult to do that. Like, there's mushrooms that grow, but I think you can make a sort of shitty soup out of it.
It's true, real life, so.
But, Chris, you were saying you played that
one. Yeah, I did the same way, because when Minecraft came out, I was veggie as well. I can't really think of... I mean, I committed to it, but, like, only because eating meat in games felt weirdly transgressive in a way that... Doing other things in games that I wouldn't do in real life, like killing people and punching the ground.
No moral issues there, but just a difficult thing to do.
Yeah, exactly. Those things didn't feel transgressive in the game, but for some reason, punching pigs to death in order to eat them did.
I think the pigs in Minecraft are cuter, and therefore it's wronger to kill them than it is to kill real pigs.
In real life, even as someone who eats meat, I wouldn't punch a pig to death and then immediately eat what would remained, like raw and without you.
Yeah.
Hypocrite.
I haven't done that in a long time now.
Yeah, exactly. And I do, I mean, we've spoken so much about my weird playthrough foibles, but I'm constantly making weird, arbitrary decisions about how I'm going to play a game. Like, I don't like to shoot shopkeepers in Grand Theft Auto V when I rob shops. I like to back out of the door backwards. Because sometimes they pull a gun on you if you turn. So I just walk out of every... I walk into the inevitably masked police outside backwards every single time to avoid having to kill the convenience store owner.
I think there are very few games which actually countenance any kind of ideological position that would be in any way, produce friction with the game. And this just doesn't happen very often, does it?
So in Spelunky, the best way to play really is to kill the shopkeepers after a certain point. You should borrow every shop, because if you're good enough at it, then not only do you get all the items, but you get to keep all your money. And for a long time, I just wouldn't do it because I just didn't like it. I just didn't want to be killing everyone. I didn't want to be wanted. I didn't want to be stealing everything. It just felt really kind of cheap and nasty. And I also just really liked the economy, and I wanted to save up money and buy things. Mm. I'm just such an addict to capitalist society that I wasn't prepared to murder people, even when it was in my interests. And I kind of, weirdly, eventually that broke down and I caved and I did kill shopkeepers, and that's how I got to hell, and I eventually completed the game the hard way and sort of did the ultimate achievement, not the hardest achievement, but kind of the completed it the real way. And then since then I haven't really done it again. When I play it now, I don't kill shopkeepers. I've gone back to my moral stance of, like, now that I have what I want, I'm prepared to be ethical again.
I think I get it in almost every, like, 4X game or even management game where I kind of want to create... Because of the victory conditions, because they're ultimately strategy games, the victory conditions are always kind of absolute in some way, like literally kill everybody or convince everybody to believe what you believe or build a rocket and leave the Earth or whatever. Whereas I kind of like the bit where it's kind of like, I have a functioning state that's kind of at peace with all its neighbours and trotting along happily in the middle of the pack, but that's how you lose.
Yeah. Jonathan Norman says... Dear CNC Rumalert.
That's nice. I just got that.
He describes
these two.
Something quite horrific. Whilst having a motorbike lesson, I made a mistake which resulted in me tumbling to the ground. I hurt my left thumb, so I couldn't grip my right knee, so I had to limp, and fractured my right elbow, so I couldn't move it much. I was able to use an Xbox 360 controller to play games if I had it on my lap, but I struggled to drink since I couldn't grip the cup with my left hand or get it close enough to my face with my right. Have you ever injured yourself in such a way that it affects your ability to play games? Thanks for the podcast, and I've mostly recovered now. This isn't the first time that a listener has had a bike-based calamity and written in about it. I think we've actually answered this question before, but I think it's worth repeating. Stay safe out there.
Don't listen to the podcast and turn corners.
No.
It sounds like this guy did not injure himself because of us, but the last guy did. Yeah. It was actually our fault. Like, we laughed too loud and he fell off his bike.
Yeah.
That was too loud, Mush. Just take that laugh.
Sorry, whoever was...
Apologies to who just died.
I don't have an answer to this particularly, but I did mention before that I get RSI from using a mouse and keyboard for too long, and so I tend to play things with gamepads these days if I can. Like, so I'm intentionally veering towards anything I can play with a gamepad. So I probably will play a lot of GTA 5.
Mm. Oh, well, there is actually an RSI question later. I don't even know where his name is on this. Oh, it's there. Stixie, who wrote on our forum about... dealing with RSI. Do you have any suggestions about how to cope with that if you're a gamer?
No.
Right, okay.
I'm just trying to avoid using mouse and keyboard because I use mouse and keyboard all day.
Right.
Did you reply to this guy on the forum, Chris?
There was the left-handed person.
Yeah.
There was a left-handed person I replied to on the forum.
Mm. Oh, is that not the same thing?
It is. He is also left-handed and an RSI sufferer.
Yeah, I can help with the left-handedness, not with the RSI.
Tom, you experimented with an ergonomic keyboard, one of those split, tilted things.
Yeah, I still use that, actually.
Does that work?
Yeah, what I found was useful was I used that at home. Oh, no. Actually, I ended up using them at home and at work. But for a while, I was using like a normal keyboard at work and an ergonomic one at home, and vice versa. And actually, just kind of changing is a good thing in general. But now I'm somewhat rethinking that, because when I do my video tutorial things, I have to do them on my laptop because that's got a webcam built into it. And that actually doesn't... I could plug in an ergonomic keyboard into it, but the keyboard I happen to have for it is just a normal one. And my ability to type on that is so poor. It really causes genuine problems. And I think the episodes are taking like 10 minutes longer than they would do if I could just type a normal sentence at a normal rate, which is kind of dumb. But I like ergonomic keyboards in general.
It's funny, like, I used to think that those keyboards were really, really weird, with the angles and everything else. But I realised in responding to this question on the forum, because it was also about having to switch from using a... It was... because there's a problem, if you're left-handed and use your mouse in your left hand, which is what I do, but you also use right-handed keyboard controls, which are based around WASD, you have a problem where the vast majority of the keyboard is to your right.
Yeah.
So your left hand's on the mouse, your right hand's on the left-hand side of the keyboard, which means that the vast amount of keyboard real estate is, like, actually far away from you.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're right-handed, it's kind of in your centre. And so what I do, and I didn't realise until I had to write it down that I do this, is tilt the keyboard at an angle so that the rest of the keys are on, like, the curvature of my elbow, because otherwise you have to move your shoulder. So, and which is actually functionally the same as having an ergonomic keyboard, because it switches the angle of the keyboard from just a straight line in front of your monitor to pointing towards your monitor, which is how I tend to use a keyboard now. I don't know if that's interesting. I did once fracture most of the bones in my right hand and learned to play Civ, the game you can play with just your mouse in one hand. Oh. You're not going to play anything else.
We got two vaguely related questions here about marketing, but they both have the almost diametrically opposite opinion of what marketing does.
Let's make them fight.
So JR writes in to make a joke about Adam Jensen walking into a bakery and saying, "So much pain." But he says that he thinks that internet memes and culture in general is like a kind of resistance to the fact of marketing as an endless phenomenon trying to make us part with our money. And he says, you know, you only need to look at how similar most AAA games look and play to see that marketing teams do a great job of trying to sell us more flavourless game paste and tell us it's pate.
Doesn't pate mean paste?
Yeah, but anyway.
Pie is tasty paste.
So much pate.
Well, the example he uses of this is that Human Revolution is a game that doesn't really need a marketing team to sell it, because it's a great game to the century, and his angle is you could just put it on Twitch and it would sell itself. Whereas, in fact, you get a kind of cinematic trailer showing Jensen as a cyber Batman and, you know, the "I never asked for this" meme in every single trailer. And so he asks, in an age when advertising your game is as easy as a Twitch stream, and where the failure of advertising can become a bigger story than the game it's shilling, what's the proper place for all the marketing and PR that goes into games? And how much is all the punning and internet macros a successful attempt to puncture it? Whereas, Yusuf Cole writes in to say, there's been a lot of discussion about the nature of video game hype machines and how certain games generate huge tidal waves of attention, that they tempt people who wouldn't normally play those games to pick them up anyway. He gives Bloodborne and the Souls games an example of this, and says that he himself wouldn't have tried to play or enjoy Dark Souls if he hadn't been advised to do so by a friend. So his question is the zeitgeist around fan favourites and powerful cultural totems actually helpful? Or are we being sucked into a singular mindset of what games are worthy of attention at the cost of countless smaller, more interesting titles? Keep hoarding those blood vials, says Yusuf. So on the one hand, you've got somebody saying that the kind of cultural phenomenon around games is a way of defying marketing, and Yusuf seems to think that
it's a product of, and
can actually dampen down the kind of diversity of games. I don't think either of them are right.
Like, I kind of think that, I don't think that memes are necessarily a natural reaction against marketing. I think there is this kind of level of cynicism about the absurdity of certain marketing gestures that happens in games. I don't think that's really counter to marketing, though. And I think
I really like that, you know, it, the way it deflates certain marketing things, which is not necessarily undermining them, but just, the way I never asked for this became a meme. It just makes me really happy, even though I love Deus Ex Human Revolution, the story, and I even like, I think that line should be in there, you know, if I was writing it and that, or if I was in charge of it and someone wrote that line, I would be like, yes, that should be in there. Cause that, I remember, actually, recently I just listened to, the PC Gamer podcast where we first discussed having played Deus Ex Human Revolution, and it's me, Graham Smith, Rich McCormick, and Tim Edwards, all talking about our first impressions of it, and, Rich and Graham, I think, both mentioned which choice they made in that decision. So even before it was a meme, it wasn't a thing that people were talking about back then, but it was still a kind of pivotal moment where both of them felt like that was the time when they decided what their character felt about this whole thing and what path they were kind of, what character they were playing. But also, yeah, I love the way that it's kind of mocked and therefore sort of takes away some of its gravitas. Because it doesn't actually spoil the game experience, it's just kind of, I really like just stepping back from games and just acknowledging, this is silly. I got robot fucking arms, and it's they're going to be for no reason, and I'm barely questioning it.
robot fucking arms.
And then I really hope that what's the name of the new one?
Mankind Divided.
Fucking arms.
I really hope... I really hope So Much Pain becomes the new meme for that one. Just because that's something that kind of needs deflating, because it is silly, and particularly in that context where you are going to shove your fist chisels through people, and now you can shoot them across the room through people.
I do see a reason that those trailers need to exist to promote Deus Ex as an action game. Like, they will get more sales as a result of that, and they will introduce people who had not necessarily bought that game to things, you know. And so it is in some way sort of deceitful and meaningless, but as is all advertising. But at the same time, it does serve a purpose of getting that game, a good game, into the hands of people who will then appreciate it.
I don't think memes are a counter to advertising either. I think
they're often part of it.
There have been very embarrassing examples of corporations trying to manufacture memes, like the Disney attempts to do were really, really terrible. But like, a lot of companies are actually very effective at doing it and putting it on Reddit. And so I think some of the memes you read are probably manufactured by marketing departments anyway.
The flip side to that, I think, is that I don't think marketing has quite the amount of power that marketing has a vested interest in
telling people it does.
But also the cynical people kind of can assume that it does. They assume that other people are brainwashed in their tastes, whereas you are righteous in believing in your own preferences. I think people are, I think memes, when they're taken from marketing, are one instance of a kind of critical or knowing response to marketing, like picking something out as absurd and celebrating it and making something else out of it. The other thing is that, in answer to Yusuf's question about hype, I was trying to think about whether or not there's been a recent example of a game that was broadly hyped and, had that kind of cultural upswell that associates the game everyone has to play and everyone has to have an opinion on, that was actually shite, as opposed to just not for everybody. Maybe people will be drawn to Dark Souls by the groundswell around it and not like it. But I don't think anyone would question the legitimacy of most of the praise for that game. I don't think that's creating a mush at all. You think of these great historical examples of things like Daikatana, where this thing is vast hype surrounding it, and then it turns out to be total dog shit and everyone looks stupid. But the information channels are much more open now. It's not just information about a game trickling out through a tiny number of outlets. Normally, I don't think stuff gets to that stage unless it's...
I've seen, not to that stage, but the closest example I can think of recently where, just from looking at the reaction, I never even played it myself, but Watch Dogs was the thing where people were super excited about it right up until a certain point where suddenly it was the devil and... they hated it, and it had been totally ruined.
Well, look at GTA 5. The reviews for that when it came to launch were very, very positive. And in the last year now, we come to it with a level of critical appraisal which is a lot more negative about.
Perhaps, but I think that's, I mean, that, in my
case, wasn't a word of mouth
that's a reaction to the things people have criticised it for since. Like, this is a weird situation with GTA where it has been out for 18 months and most people have seen all of it, and that's fine. I'm trying to think of an example for something that was genuinely a big cultural moment and also genuinely really bad, where marketing has totally won because the kind of forces of is this good have failed.
Yeah, like, I don't think that happens a lot, but there is a risk of there being kind of a monocultural... A monoculture.
A monoculture.
Yeah, let's just go with monoculture.
Monocle.
about these things, and people who disagree with that are cast out as pariahs. And I can see that happening with things like Bloodborne, although I disagree with the people who completely slate those games. Like, they are treated as scum.
But I think you've wandered outside of marketing there and, like, into just... It's a cultural pattern, I think, rather than a monocultural response to a game.
Yeah.
Where... You have the reaction, then you have the backlash, then you have the backlash to the backlash. Mm. And that happens every single fucking time. It happened to Bioshock Infinite, it'll happen to Bloodborne, it'll happen to GTA, it'll happen to any game of a certain profile. And that happens after advertising, that happens after the hype has already been generated. That's the process of how op-eds work, really, where it's kind of like, well, you think this? Well, I think that.
Yeah.
Deal with it.
The other thing is, I know we talk about these things in a fairly privileged position of being, or having been journalists who write about this stuff. But there is a reason to play games which are cultural totems for the sake of them being cultural totems, you know? Mm. I mean, it is interesting to know what's popular, it's interesting to know what's touched a lot of people in certain ways. I like those robot fucking arms. it doesn't really matter whether they're good or not. Like COD, like I'm always interested to play a new COD game, not because I'm going to enjoy it, because I usually fucking hate those games. But it's interesting to know what kind of mass media PARP is being farted into the face of the
young. That's why I watch Transformers movies on planes.
Yeah,
it's like, but it's actually, yeah, that's an interesting kind of case, because, like, I think that process of, like, I need to understand COD in order to understand how alienated I am from the vast majority of people who enjoy the hobby that I cover for a living. And, you know, I played Advanced Warfare a fair bit and I hated it. And that is, you know, a vastly, vastly, vastly profitable enterprise where literally no sign of that profit is shown in the quality of the product that's subsequently made at all. They buy Kevin Spacey. They buy and recreate Kevin Spacey. Congratulations, what a brilliant use of everyone's money. Pricks. But then that's what actually really surprised me about GTA. It was one of the things is like, holy shit, they actually kind of, I mean, obviously they're all totally, totally fucking minted thanks to that game, or that series. But that game really shows where the money goes when people make shitloads of money from a previous GTA game, because it's
crazy. They haven't fucking skimped, have they?
Yeah, really? Whereas, like, you know, there's the parallel universe where GTA is an annualized franchise that is exactly the same every single time to a template, and it's really depressing. That's a bit of an aside, but it's sort of it's a shame that that's so novel, where you go like, holy shit, they made this thing and made shitloads of money, then they spent ages and loads of money making another one that then made loads of money.
I think the concept
and neither of, like, approach works better.
The concept of marketing winning, I think, does happen all the time. Yeah. I don't know, the games that it happens for aren't necessarily ones where the critics think it's going to be fucking amazing. So, you know, Alien Squadron Marines sold really well.
I was going to say that. Yeah.
But also, like, I think Call of Duty Black Ops, I just thought was really fucking badly made, even for what it was. Even if you like that kind of thing, I just think it was shoddy on a fundamental level. And of course it sold amazingly well, and it was never going to be stopped by anything like that. And that wasn't a game where I don't think the critical previews were massively excited about it. I think they were optimistic. They were like, oh, it's an interesting kind of setting, I guess. But yeah, that, you know, sold because of marketing and because of franchise loyalty.
There was with Cloning Marines, I think it's a standout thing, because there were actually some positive words about Cloning Marines. I remember from preview coverage and stuff, like, more than you'd expect given what a fucking shambles it was when it eventually came out. And that seems like a unusual out of order failure of critical system.
It's worth saying that
we were quite critical of it.
We were, yeah.
Yeah, and there's a big weird preconception amongst people that the press have always praised everything, and that if there were previews of a thing, therefore it was being praised, and that means the press are excited about it. And in fact, certainly PC Gamer, the only place I have first hand knowledge of, has a very long history of giving negative previews of covering stuff where we're covering it because it's a big deal. Everyone wants to know about it. It's worth covering even if it's bad because people are excited about it. but the preview will tell you this is, we're really worried about how this is going to turn out. And obviously it would be wrong to judge it at that point, but there are lots and lots of examples of previews where we told you it was going to fucking suck and then it fucking sucked.
Some people really do confuse coverage with hype, where it's not really the same thing. Like, I saw this name, therefore I bought it.
A lot of marketers think that.
But, you know, well, it's kind of true now in the era where your Twitter accounts can be bought and not declare their allegiances.
Not just Twitter accounts. If you want someone to honk at your game, just
that's a stump up. The social media chain article was very good today.
Oh, though. God, that made me want to fucking kill myself. But only after I killed everybody else. I've seen that article.
We should link it in the show notes that you too can experience Marsh's despair.
Absolute barrel of humanity. Like, you remember, if you guys read Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy?
Yeah.
Well, I would just tell you anyway, this thing you already know. But at some point in the prehistory of humanity, on a planet, they get all the telephone sanitizers together and all the hairdressers and all the other completely useless people in society, put them on an ark and tell them that there's a great global catastrophe coming and they're going to be sent out on this ark to populate another planet. Then they just send the ark out. And obviously there isn't a global calamity. But clearly, the people from social chain are the new telephone sanitizers. For the internet generation.
If Doug Turns was here today, I think he would agree.
We need to put them on an arc. We need to put them on an arc. Send them out.
And they'll become the basis of a new race.
Yeah, there are levels of irony in that which I've not expressed, but you should read the books. We've received probably the most important and vital criticism we've ever received on the podcast, actually, from Henry Stenhouse, who writes on Twitter to say, "Dear Great British Bake Off, cheesecake is a delicious dessert any time of the year. Satsuma slices are a great topping."
He's not wrong.
Mm. Yeah.
Spectacular observation. Mm. His wisdom.
A brutal takedown of our previous stance that those things were not true.
We'll amend our ethics policy.
I think you've slept with a Satsuma once, haven't you, Chris?
I always said something fucking awful, but I didn't. Because ultimately this podcast has limits.
And on that note, we have reached the limits of this podcast. Those are all the questions we've had. If you want to send us more questions, you can do so by sending them to questions@CratonCrowbar.com.
Or you can tweet us at CratonCrowbar. Or leave a question on the forum at CratonCrowbar.com/forum if you'd like to tweet us as individuals at as individuals. That phrase doesn't make any sense, and I've said like 70 times. You can do so.
You can follow us on Twitter.
As individuals by following Tom.
Mine is Marsh Davis, and that's I'm Tom Senior, and it's at PCGLudo.
I'm at Marsh Davis, DAVIES. Listen to my distinctive voice.
And I, Tom Francis, am at Pentadact, PENTADACT.
And myself, Chris Thurston, am at CTHURSTEN, C Thurston.
Well done for spelling your own name.
Thanks.
And thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening, everyone.
Thanks for listening, everybody.
Everybody.
Marsh, be polite.
I was waiting for Tom to say thanks for listening.
I said the first two parts of it.
Okay, well, this has got to fuck some Satsumas.
My robot fucking arms.